This is seriously the worst moment at the Court of Common Pleas. It trumps even the purple dildo vibrator thing, which had a moment of funny. I thought it was pink.
I think it was pink.
David Schmidt. Okay, look, I didn't get that good a look at it. Okay?
Started pink and then turned purple.
Whatever.
It was. I had a vibrator vibrating on my table. Okay, I wanted it to go away. Is what I wanted.
Welcome to Nerd Burger, episode 46. I'm Mike.
And I'm Craig.
Hey, Craig.
Hi, how are you doing over there, Mikey?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, good, good. Have you been keeping up on the... I'm happy on behalf of somebody. Have you been keeping up on the Kickstarter for Chaosmos?
Yes.
Are you looking at it right now?
No, not right now.
Oh.
Hang on.
No, that's okay. I've got it right here.
Oh, okay.
What do you think they're up to?
I'm going to guess that they are in the six figures.
They're well into the six figures.
Well into the
six hours
one,
to go.
115.
125.
Whoa!
1,000. 1,500 backers. 6 hours to go. By the time this episode airs, it'll all be over. And if you haven't bought your copy of the game,
you lose, you suck.
Because you lost out on a really cool game that has a ton of stuff that got tacked into it because of all the stretch goals. They were adding stretch goals yesterday.
So it's almost like they're giving you money.
Kinda. let's dive into our guest, I suppose. That sounds terrible.
In pill form?
Well, right. We shrink ourselves down. A la the Fantastic Voyage, and we'll travel around inside of Jim. In the year of our Lord, 1500. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, everybody. I'm being dove into.
What's that feel like?
Oddly titillating.
You.
How's your colon?
It's a secret to life. Am I breaking up?
Yeah, we had some issues, but sometimes we do when we have music playing, too.
Oh, I see. No, I was just going to say, Eddie Murphy told us years ago that the secret to life is a healthy colon. So, Eddie Murphy
would never lie to you.
No, unless he's picking up transvestites on Wilkes-Barre Boulevard. But it's good to be here. Hey, Nerdburger. Okay, I got to know, what's the game you're pitching? What's the game I don't want to miss out on?
That you have 6 hours to buy right now. It's called Chaosmos, like a combination of chaos and cosmos.
Ah, very good. I will take a look. No, you make it sound like that Reaper thing that came out where you got, I think, a billion skeleton figures if you bought in.
Well, no, it's not quite that many pieces. But, you know, they were cranking out new stretch goals yesterday.
Awesome.
Because it was just, you know, it did the thing that the Kickstarters do where it went really big really quick. And then it kind of leveled off and just slowly increased over the course of a couple of weeks. And now the last, like, 4 days, it's shot up like $30,000.
So they're scrambling to come up with extras?
Yeah, because they want you to, you know, get even more people and make the game even better.
I want to throw out just two very quick observations about Kickstarter. Number one, it appears that you either get all your money, and in fact, all of everybody's money, or you get no money whatsoever. It doesn't seem to be that merely makes them. There are some of these games that I go online and I say, we're at 14,000 times our goal. Well done. And there are others that have $6.
and their goal is 80,000.
Right. And that's the other thing. I really think it's like bidding on eBay. You should set your goal as $10, even if you're designing a new piece of software.
Yeah.
Because then people will jump on board. But the other one is, and just a brief little anecdote, I jumped on board for the Ogre Designers Edition.
O-G-R-E, all caps.
Yeah. Exactly. From Steve Jackson Games. It's hysterical. I bought Ogre in its first edition in 1983, I want to say.
Sure.
You know, little high school Jimmy has his little pocket boxed version of Ogre. And it came in, and Steve Jackson specialized in these. They were little plastic cases, probably about 6x4. And they snapped together. And inside were paper counters, cardboard counters, paper rules, and a little stapled booklet. And we played them stupid. This box that the Ogre Designer Edition comes in is a coffee table.
Does it have legs that fold out underneath it?
It should. It doesn't. I consider that a design flaw. It seriously has over the count. I forgot it. It's 2,500 pieces.
Yikes.
And I'm going, this is absurd. And the box is ridiculous. No, Kickstarter has done some amazing, amazing things.
And how many of those pieces are now in your sofa and under your fridge and no. in your son's room hidden somewhere? It's
inside the dog. You got to send a pill down there to find it.
Okay, so we're going to do the colonoscopy show. Cool. But no, the thing with that game is it's so big. It's one of those things that you set it to the side and you tell yourself, I can't touch this. I can't even look at this until I have some time to commit to it.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to spend, I'm not joking, 4 to 5 hours putting the game together. At which point now I will have enjoyment because I've been living the life of an 18-year-old Chinese girl in some Apple factory.
Whoa.
Oh, come on. They're 14.
That's true. What am I saying? By 18, you're old and you're turned over to the sex slavery business.
Ouch.
But, you know, tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong.
I'm afraid I can't.
Yeah. So, but no, it's
amazing. You sent us somewhere and told only have a male children.
Oh, God. Yeah, this is getting.
Can we go to news?
I'll be over here.
Happy Groundhog Day.
Yes, Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow.
Effer.
Yep. 6 more weeks of winter. Can't have enough of that here in Atlanta.
Yeah, apparently you deal with that well.
Yeah, my 25-hour commute Tuesday to Wednesday.
Oh.
Well, you got to sleep during part of that.
That's true.
You weren't in the car for 25 hours.
No, no. Unlike some of the other lemmings, I didn't just sit there. I, you know, took action and did what I could and got my car off the highway and onto the side of the road somewhere where it was safe to park. And I walked about a mile and I stayed at a friend's house.
I got 18 miles in 6 hours. I made it home.
Because you were lucky enough to leave a half an hour before I did.
Right. And it was nearly perfect because I didn't get any accidents. I didn't get stuck at any point. I got to the my apartment building and went in the back entrance mm-hmm. because I didn't want to deal with the front road, road around the front, which was, you know, bumper to bumper parking lot. Mm-hmm. But the back entrance,
the hill,
if you recall, has a little bit of an incline.
Yeah, how'd that go?
Poorly at first. My first try didn't get up there because I had to get the gate to open too.
Yeah.
But there was a friendly neighbor who was out walking her dog. And she came over and we timed it and she hit the gate and I was down at the bottom of the hill. And as the gate was opening, I started barreling up the hill.
Yeah.
And I made it.
Any indication anyone down there resorted to cannibalism?
Not that I know of.
No, there was at least one baby born and I think 2 people that died.
Whoa. Okay, so with respect to the dead, the baby being born is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Just curious because people get stuck in the cold. It seems to be their first move.
Dying?
No, resorting to cannibalism.
Oh, sure. No, actually, when you get
Donner
into...
party of 7, no, I mean I've... 6, I mean 5.
The movies have taught me that when things go to hell, the first thing that happens is, and forgive me for even bringing the subject up on Nerdburger, rape. Because I watched World War Z.
Yeah.
And within mere hours of the end of the world sort of beginning, they had to put the female lead in danger, and that's what they came up with.
Yeah,
they're all in a store trying to get some supplies, and somebody, you know, 2 guys come after and try to rape her. It's like, really, you couldn't come up with, you know, some other life threatening thing? That's where humanity goes, huh?
Well, it's a world filled with zombies, and that wasn't sufficiently threatening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
anyway. No, the real darkness is in our loins.
You sound like you're Catholic.
Yeah, I am, for one thing. And number 2, yes, we are very interested in your loins.
So,
I like saying that.
Okay, is that it for the Snowmageddon?
Yeah, sure.
For Atlanta, what else do you got? It's been talked to death down here. I don't really need to talk about it anymore.
Let's see.
Can I say that we're watching it with detached amusement?
Yeah. You can go ahead and say whatever you want.
What would Jim like to talk about?
I don't know.
Here we go. FAA puts microbrewery's drone beer delivery project on ice.
Oh, on ice. That's yeah.
A nearly clever. Unbelievable video of a drone that delivers 12 packs of beer to ice fishers on a frozen lake. turns out to be too good to be true. Beer maker Lake Maid created the video as a riff on Amazon's announcement on 60 Minutes last month. But where Amazon's vision of the future is just that, a vision, Lake Maid was well into the process of creating such a service for local beer delivery, though those plans have been put on ice by the Federal Aviation Administration. Wah, wah. They think it's a great idea, though they're telling me to stop, Lake Maid President Jack Supple told The Verge, adding that FAA considers the project commercial and therefore off limits until those policies are reviewed and potentially revised next year. Hang on, I gotta see where Lake Maid is.
So
what? Wait.
Stevens what's the Point, name? Wisconsin.
Well done, Wisconsin.
What's the official's name?
Supple.
That's outstanding.
No, Lake Maid President Jack Supple.
His name is Supple. Mm-hmm. I hope his first name is Soft And.
That's his middle name.
Well, his first name is Soft, and his middle initial is N.
That boy, wow. But no, I can't believe you bring this up, because I'm known up here as a drone obsessive.
Oh yeah.
Because when that thing appeared, I watched it on 60 Minutes. I don't watch 60 Minutes, but I heard that it's Bezos. Yeah, Bezos.
Whatever. Yeah, Amazon guy.
Yeah. Yeah, Amazon dude.
Crazy Amazon dude.
When I heard Amazon dude was going to talk about anything, I wanted to see it because I'm interested in him. And all of a sudden, he starts talking about drone deliveries, and I completely freaked out, because I said, oh my God, I'm having drone parties. Wouldn't you? Just order something and wait for the drones to arrive?
Well, yeah.
I'd be out in my backyard getting, I don't care what
take bets on which one comes first.
The problem is, well, and you could have stuff being delivered throughout the party, whatever you needed. So you would never overorder.
Right. No.
And then if you're in the South, you'd get the guys all together with their guns. And by the time you got like halfway, three quarters of the way into the party, when the drones started showing up, that becomes gun fun.
Target practice. Yeah.
I can order a pen, right? I want a Parker Dualfold Blue. Deliver it by drone, please.
And I've got the Prime membership, so I'm getting this for free.
This sucker is free, yeah. Absolutely. And I got my 10 or 11 friends out back. This is an afternoon, people.
What should we order now? What can we make the drone carry? Will they? Do you think they package everything, or does the drone just grab it? So will people see drones flying through the air with merchandise?
It's like a claw game at Denny's.
Like a claw game, and it drops it down to you.
No, the thing you do is you try to get as big a party as possible, as many people, and you all order at once,
and then have a race.
No, you have congestion, drone congestion.
Jeez,
let the drones fight for the airspace. Just sit back and watch.
Thunder drone.
I'm setting up a spotter tower right outside my house. Incoming from the South, people. Incoming from the South.
Wow. That is
and now they're going to do it with beer. Well, first of all, yeah, Stephen's point. Years and years ago, when I was a journalist, I got assigned to somewhere up in the Ozaukee, Washington County area of Wisconsin to cover the Bark Lake fishery.
Okay.
And I went out there and I bundled up and I there nice. And I get up there at I think I was there at 8 a.m. out on the ice, and I was told I was late because these guys were already out there for 3 to 4 hours. And it wasn't until I got into the bar that I saw the sign that said that this back then was the 35th annual Bark Lake fishery.
And they were all hammered.
Oh, my God, yes. There was seriously a guy doing donuts on the ice with his Ford F-150.
Wow.
At 8, 9 a.m. And I'm going, is that in any universe a good plan? Is there a universe in which ice is made of, concrete and this works? But I'm watching all this, and yes, and this gets to my point, the idea that you could deliver these people beer by drone, I think, and one of the fellows I talked to indicated he worked construction in the summer. During the winter, he couldn't. He made his living winning fisheries.
Oh, God.
So first of all, thank God for the life you have. But secondly, Yeah, but secondly, can you imagine what a boon to that industry, such as it is, would be the coming of the drone booze, the drone beer run? Wow, that's outstanding.
Oh.
Well, hopefully they FAA and all of them get everything sorted out. And one day soon, it will be reality.
Dirty, no funsters.
One can only hope.
Is that it for news?
I guess so. Jim, let's say we take a trip back in time again.
All right.
Both literally and figuratively, because literally taking a trip back 13 or 14 years ago.
Do you have a time machine?
Sure. It's right here in front of me.
Literally?
Yes. Literally. And also figuratively to the year 1574. The Bristol Renaissance Fair. We've talked
about... No theme music for the Ren Fair?
Sorry, I don't have any of that.
Some guy with a flute?
I didn't bring my penny whistle.
Aw, your recorder.
Yeah. But the Court of Common Pleas, we mentioned it in passing, I think a couple of times on the show. Jim, you were kind of the head honcho of the Court of Common Pleas. Let's talk about that a little bit and try to see if we can on a podcast explain what that thing was.
Well, it goes all the way back. Boy, it has to go. It's somewhere in the mid to late 90s. There had always been at the court, which is the fancy people in the really expensive clothes with the queen and all the earls and dukes and counts, there had always been a privy council, which paralleled the privy council in actual Elizabethan England. And they talked about high affairs of state and the affairs of the high and the mighty.
And the affairs of the latrines.
The affairs of the latrines, yeah, all those things.
Not that kind of privy.
Yeah, I was walking away. I figured that we were going to let that one stand on its own. There we go. Some brother needs a rim shot. But the director of the fair came to me and said, hey, could we do something like Privy Council? What would that be for the middle and lower classes? And I took that little bit of direction and I said, and I went out and I found a name and I just literally borrowed the name. There is a Court of Common Pleas, still is in England. It's not at all what we took it to do, but it was a good, it was a good name. And it was a very, very simple premise. It tried to set a very, very limited set of rules and let people take it, which was Sir Edward Coke, Justice Attorney General to Her Majesty the Queen, who actually did ride the circuit in Elizabethan England, would show up in town with his bad guys, and because he had to, set up a court. And that court would hear whatever matters were waiting from the last time he was there, at least notionally 3 months ago, because he made the tour every 3 months, every quarter. So there he was. And from that, and I can still remember the day at the Bristol Academy of Performing Arts class when I started telling folks we were going to do it, I said, look, bring whatever you want, just so long as it sounds like it could be a court case of any kind.
Right.
And I said, look, A, it's going to be a little bit silly. You're going to hit and you're going to miss.
That's an understatement.
You know, and like everything else, it sort of started to take on a life of its own. We always did it in the same place. We always worked to try to make it as big a thing as we could. But it eventually started to develop its own tropes. You know, I came up with a way of starting it and just saying some things that indicated it was starting. We'd give a God Save the Queen. But then at some point, very early on, it started to be an actual concern that a lot of the participants that were coming were wearing their weapons, because the good guys and the bad guys and even some of the characters carry staves and swords and knives. They said, you know, we might do some movement. We might do some bouncing around. Let's not have that be dangerous. Let's have them put them to the side. And so we did that as a reminder.
Here we go.
And so I said, all right, let's have a weapons check. And I thought that this would be a simple way of reminding people. You don't do something simple at Bristol and not expect somebody to dick around with it.
and not at Court of Common Pleas, which already, you know, was building a reputation of like you take things as far as you can push them without bungee cording the audience out of the period and reminding them that they're in the present day without getting too ridiculous or ticking off the artistic director.
What's the term for that?
What? Bungee cording.
Oh, that is
that's
the
what
term.
We called it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the it's notion being
sucking the, you know, anachronism. Well, I guess, un-anachronizing them.
Yeah, it's the notion is everybody walks into the Bristol Renaissance Fair with this bungee cord attached to their back. And they go through the fair, and it's pulling at them and pulling at them. And they're being immersed in the 16th century. They're hearing good dialect. They're seeing good shows. And then somebody says something that's clearly 2002, and it snaps them back to the front door.
Like me and Vooch doing our Sattler and Waldorf impression.
That might be one.
Somebody's cell phone going off.
Right. So, right. It's, you know, somebody having a live mic.
I don't know.
And you can't control the patrons, but we had to keep it under control. Yeah.
Right.
As performers.
And you know, it was always a funny thing, because I think if you winked at it, you know, it was like a little or an elbow nudge, it was fine. It's when you did it so overtly that you screwed it up. You know, if the audience was in on the joke and you knew and they knew and you knew that they knew that it was a bungee cord, that was fine. But when you did it just to do it, that's where it screwed it up.
Right. And but anyway, Weapons Check just started spiraling into this goofier and goofier thing.
It started metastasizing. And the next thing you know, sure, it starts off with a nice big pile of swords and daggers. A couple weeks later, I've got wooden swords. A couple weeks later, I've got, what do you call those big plastic tubes that people hit each other with in the pool?
Right.
Oh, noodles.
Noodles, that's it. I've got seven or eight noodles. One day.
Brightly colored noodles.
Yeah, neon, brought like pink, and
brought like 14 noodles and just dumped them. And it became a gag that Sir Edward had to come out from behind the bench and observe what had been left. And if you go to my Facebook page to this day, there is a picture of me in the middle of that pile of weapons holding up an 8-month-old baby.
I was about to go there because it eventually became small patron children.
And I
would get brought over and laid on this big rug where we threw all the weapons.
And I remember it wasn't my picture. Somebody tagged me in it, and I looked at it and went, why am I holding a baby? For the love of God. And somebody posted it was Weapons Check. And I went, oh, yeah. And so we had this baby. I kept the baby. But later on, and it probably the most famous in my mind, other than the baby, was the time somebody left a loaded Super Soaker.
Oh, I got a more famous one than that.
All right, I'll the one I remember, and the reason I guess I remember it is they assumed I'd leave it there. I absolutely did not.
You went out and got it, and
I picked it up, and I sat there, and I dispensed some liquid justice as I chose to during the course of it. And so when I retired in 2002, some really really nice folks got together and got me a caricature of myself, and it turns out that caricature depicts me at the Court of Common Pleas. And sitting behind me on the bench is a Super Soaker labeled Justice. So Craig, yours was?
There was one that this one actually brought Ron Scott Fry, the creative director of the fair, to Court of Common Pleas the following day to watch us and make his presence known.
Oh,
in
God.
Costume and looking at us to make sure we didn't do that again.
Yeah.
I was sitting underneath the table that Jim and the guards are at, and the weapons check goes mostly gets thrown on this rug, but some people will come and place things on the table. Mm-hmm. And somebody who will remain nameless comes up. I know who it was, but I'm not going to say.
Yeah.
Comes up and sets something on the table. And I hear, and something's bouncing around on the table.
Oh, no.
It was pink. Mm-hmm. It was phallic.
Yeah.
And it was...
Was it veiny?
And it was turned on and moving around.
Yeah.
And everybody gasped, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And people, like, you know, then there's the laughter started. And there was another fellow out there who I know as well. I think we can say who this was, because he tried to fix it. Somebody tried to fix it. Maybe it wasn't Mark. Mark fixed it. Mark finished it.
No, it was actually Mark did the other thing, too.
Well, somebody had put a metal pitcher on the table.
We always had a pitcher for water up there.
Right. And so he grabbed the thing and put it so that it would be out of sight as quickly as possible. Where can I put this so that you won't see it? In the pitcher. Uh-huh. So now it's in a metal pitcher going...
and sparking.
Echoing the sound around. And then finally Mark said, it's a bomb! And he grabbed it and went running off. And within a couple hours, that story circulated to the guy in charge. And the next day, he was in costume standing on the sideline with his arms crossed, just looking at all of us.
Glaring.
Yes. Yeah. Like, don't you even think about doing something like that. And that might have been like the bungee cordless day that we had. Like, that day we were probably really, really in period.
Yeah, we might have actually done 16th century court cases. I'm not sure. But, that event, that show... Susan Scott Fry, the artistic director's wife, once said she never knew whether to make sure that the Court of Common Pleas appeared on the brochure for people coming into the fair, so they made sure to find it, or whether to shut it down because it was that way. It gave me some of my very, very best memories of the fair because of the people that performed there, because it just was this jam for some incredibly talented people, some of whom really didn't come out of themselves that much.
Make it clear, I guess, the way we did the weapons check thing, there's an intro and an outro, but basically what it would be is typically three cases that would run about 10 minutes a piece, and there was just somebody would bring you the idea and say, I'm going to bring suit against somebody about this, and that was as much as you knew. It was all improv, and then Jim would make a judgment in favor of somebody, and you'd run from, one to two to three, and then wrap it up. It'd be about a half hour show.
And we did any number of things that stay with me. I'll give you three of my favorites. I won't say these are the best. I'll just say that they stay with me. There was a time when a yeoman of the guard came in, and he held up
the beefeater looking guy, with the red outfit.
Yeah, the guy's still kind of like the ones they still have today.
Yeah,
and he came up with these two bocce balls that he had, and he wanted to bring complaint because he indicated that someone else, another of the yeomen, had indicated that his fears were bigger than his fears. So
you see what they're doing there?
And so I looked at him.
It's an innuendo.
I was feeling it. And I looked at him and I said, so let me see if I've got this straight. You're saying that you've got big fears. He's got big fears. But gentlemen, I must inform you that I've got the biggest spheres of them all. And without missing a beat, the brilliant Chris Stryker, who is then playing Lord North, in this wonderful urbane voice of his, says, bigger than mine, Edward. And I slowly turned to him and I went, first of all, I just got crushed. And I never saw it coming. It was out of nowhere. It was coming out of the sun. And I said, my Lord North, neither myself or any of my ancestors have spheres greater than those of thine. And he looked at me and just said, that's what I thought. It was a magnificent moment. But the other two things that we decided, if things were going a little short, that we came up with a game show, and it was called Name That Crime.
Oh man!
And this
is like a trip back in history for me.
And it was, and the intent was to do more audience participation because we'd gotten that note. And so what we did, one of our guards actually came up with, she took Jenga blocks and wrote a series of punishments on them that you could draw out of the bowl. But then we started out and we would just grab anybody, whoever it was. We ever grab you, Friddle?
Oh, absolutely.
I thought so. And what we would do to the crowd, we would start.
He always just called me Friddle. He never called me by my first name. Every Friddle was just Friddle. There was a whole family of us. We were just Friddle.
Mm-hmm. As far as I was concerned, you were all fungible parts. But I looked out, what we would do is I would just call to the crowd and say, lords and ladies, gentles assembled, it's time to play everyone's favorite game show, Name That Crime. And we would start out, and I would say, all right, who we have today? Master Rupert Friddle. Is his crime a felony or a misdemeanor? And the crowd would tell me whether it was a felony or misdemeanor.
It would be the equivalent of the applausometer.
Uh-huh.
Right. Oh, the crowd thinks you committed a felony. Congratulations.
It was always a felony.
Yeah.
I got news for you.
And one time we had a crowd, I'm not exaggerating, of 150 people just screaming just at different penalties and ideas and punishments. And it would end with drawing from the bowl. And we had this one guard. He's my son's godfather, actually. He's a stunt man and a kung fu man and all this stuff in real life. And he could do some amazing physical tricks.
We've talked about him
in the last
year. Jared, the guy that runs up the tree?
That's the guy. The other thing he can do is he can stand almost face to face with you and give you one of them roadhouse wheelhouse kicks right to the face and miss
you by inches.
Right.
And the purposes of the, it looks really real. If the person reacts correctly, it looks real.
It's kind of scary.
Yeah.
And
he knows exactly how long his legs are.
and more or less where your face is. Yeah. But that was called boot to the head. And for whatever reason, on this crazy day, he was agitating in the back behind me. I didn't know this, for boot to the head to give this to this person. And he had the crowd built up, and it was not preset. It was not a joke. When I went in to pull the penalty out of the barrel, it was boot to the head. And the crowd exploded. And the crowd started chanting, boot to the head, boot to the head, boot to the head, boot to the head.
Did we mention this gets silly?
And he gave it to the person. The person did a wonderful job, reacted, fell over, got carried off, boot to the head. This has a button on it, because about 15 minutes after the show, the stage manager comes up to me and goes, "We would consider it a matter of courtesy if you didn't blow up the other stages with the Court of Common Pleas."
Because our crowd got so big that day and so loud.
We took out not one, not two, because there was one at the Pork and Blow the Pig and Whistle.
There was a little bar called the Pig and Whistle, and we called it the Pork and Blow.
There was the Pig and Whistle. There was the Queen Show stage, and there was this other little stage just down the way near the privies. And all three of them. Now the crowd from Court of Common Pleas had gone back as far as where those flushable privies are, a good 150 to 200 feet away.
Right.
And so we had blown up three separate stages. So that was, you know, well, I certainly never want to be rude to my fellow performers, who are all talented people. I was pretty proud. I was, and like Craig said, the magnificent thing about it, couldn't plan it.
No, you could never try to do that again. We never repeated stuff.
Right.
Because you'd never get it. I mean, when it came together perfectly, you never could get it to do that again. Once in a while, there'd be a gag. There was the running gag. Literally the running gag.
Sure.
Where I believe it was Thomas Gresham came in. He was the Queen's Factories, the business agent. And he brought suit against somebody. And it turned into him getting chased out of Court and Common Pleas by somebody with a dagger. And then we went on to the next case, and 5 minutes later, he chased that guy through Court of Common Pleas with a sword. And 5 minutes later, the other guy chased him through this Court of Common Pleas with two swords. It became the Bugs Bunny skit, back and forth of just the bigger weapons. And by the time he got to the end, they were actually carrying a cannon. And I think Lady Gresham came rolling through with a rolling pin one time.
Yeah.
And they did it like a couple different days, but each time they would one-up it, you know, to the bigger and bigger weapon. They actually got one of the Guild of St. Michael's cannons. Somebody was walking through with like a 30-pound cannon, trying not to drop it on a patron. But that was the most we ever, you know, like, over, you know, redid things. It was new every time.
Yeah, you tried to set a structure for it, and look, it failed. I'll be the first one to admit that there were times we were standing around going, "All right, let's not do that again." But that was the whole thing, is you learned, I flatter myself to think that those of us who were participants in it, who had some experience of it, taught people a lesson in the importance of, there's always another show, there's always another bit, don't freak out, do the next thing, and hopefully that will be hysterically funny.
Do you remember the great Friddle Switcheroo?
I do. I'll let you narrate, since you decided to screw with me that day.
Well, I came up to Jim and I just gave him the idea. I said, I wanted to make sure you were okay with it, because I was going to be replacing you.
Yes.
I got to run the show at the Court of Common Pleas for about 10 minutes. Right before the final court case, I came out, got talking with Jim. And I don't remember what it was I said to you, but I got you to come out from behind the desk. And the idea what happened was that day we had the Friddle family. And we had as many Friddle family members as there was Jim and his guards. It was an equal number. So a different Friddle would come out and lure either Jim or one of the guards away, and they'd switch hats. And by the end of it, it was me running Court of Common Pleas with the gavel, wearing Jim's black flat cap or mortarboard, and all the rest of the Friddles behind me, all carrying like the guards' weapons and wearing the guards' hats. And I don't remember to this day what the court case was that I presided over and did the whole thing at the end. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, there was part of me that was like, oh, I'd love to do this again. But I like, no, I just can't. We can't try to do this again. It went really, really well. And every Friddle had to come up with a different way to lure somebody out. The only one that sticks in my head was, I remember Alice, who was playing, she was playing twins. She would switch her costume. She lured David out with puppets because puppets were a mainstay at Court of Common Pleas. Everybody loved puppets.
If for no other reason.
She just came out and went, look, puppet. And David's playing Kit Carruthers. And he's, puppet. And he comes wandering out, and then they switched caps. And
yeah, and there was
we had eight Friddles that day, I believe.
There's spawning extras behind the shed.
Well, we had guest Friddles.
Well, but I think the thing of Court of Common Pleas generally was you have to dare to be stupid. I mean, you can't. The minute you start taking anything like that seriously, you're already absurd yourself.
Yeah.
And I have a vague memory that the case you presided over was somebody having to pass the bar, because that's the only reason I can explain the memory of being behind the Dirty Duck where this show took place.
Right.
And going to fetch a piece of wood.
Right. So that people could quote unquote pass the bar.
Right. Yeah, that's that, and bringing them out and saying, "All right, you've all passed the bar. Good luck, congratulations."
And they would walk by the bar, and
we actually had a rare moment of seriousness. I want to say this might have been the first year of the Court of Common Pleas, where the mayor, the magnificent, wonderful, and incredible Tim Ferguson, and his son Barnum Bailey. Because the mayor's name was Richard Bailey.
His son's first name was Barnum.
It was Barnum Bailey, and his sister's name was Haley Bailey. But Barnum Bailey, it was brought out, and they dragged him into the Court of Common Pleas, and I didn't know why. And suddenly it came out because it was his father who was mad at him because he wasn't attending to his studies, and I said, studies? Okay, hadn't heard any of this. What was he going to do? Oh, he's going to be a lawyer. All right. So it was at the very end of Court of Common Pleas. And I said, all right, Barnum, let's give you a midterm test to see whether or not you are able to become an attorney, an advocate in Her Majesty's courts. And the first question I gave him was some horribly obtuse piece of nonsense I had actually read from Sir Edward Cook. It was something like, if the party of the first part swears out quo warranto against Richard Roe in a matter of first passage, leaving a quo vires and vires emptor, and I said, is he or is he not entitled to redress before the bar? And Barnum says, yes. Well, of course, he couldn't give me a right answer. And then I gave him another one like that, got it wrong. And then on the third one, I said, Barnum, if you have a case in which a man of great station, power, and wealth offers you an opportunity in exchange for a favorable decision in a case, would you or would you not grant him that decision? And he thought about it, and I think he sensed it. This is John Kravitsky, who is a gifted musician. But he looked at me and said, yes, Sir Edward, I would. I would. And I said, Barnum, that's the wrong answer, for that is the dishonorable answer. It seems to me you have much to learn of the law, but it seems you have even more to learn of life. And it seems to me further that you can best learn of that by pursuing your love of music. So I urge you to do that as well. And it was this wonderful moment of, you know what? And the crowd goes, aw. And everybody goes off and everybody's happy. So in the good moments, it again keep some of my very, very best memories of my years at Fair. In the others, it leaves you standing there wondering. I'll give you the worst moment.
Oh, jeez.
This is seriously the worst moment at the Court of Common Pleas. It trumps even the purple dildo vibrator thing, which had a moment of funny.
It was pink.
I think it was David pink, but okay.
David Schmidt. Okay, look, I didn't get that good a look at it. Okay?
Started pink and then turned purple.
Whatever.
I had a vibrator vibrating on my table. Okay, I wanted it to go away is what I wanted.
All I know is that the stories I heard afterward was like multiple people had their heads down on the table. They were laughing so hard. Jared was offended and walked away.
And that's Bardolph when he joined Subway?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bardolph Simple couldn't breathe. He was in serious, serious pain. That was very, very bad for him.
Okay, so the worst moment.
The worst moment was we had a guy, David Schmidt, who was a talented street director, and what he always wanted to do is bring in the kids. He always wanted to bring down a troop of young kids from the patrons to have a case. And it was always blindingly simple so the kids could handle it. And there was this one guy in the court, in the Revelers Guild, who had these very big pansied slops, those really big pumpkin pants that you wear kind of at the waist.
Pumpkin pants, bulbous.
Yeah.
Makes your butt look like an onion.
Yeah, when he said pumpkin pants, I got it. But pansied slops,
that's
what
they're called historically.
But so I
does this have something to do with the vibrator?
Okay. It does not. And David Schmidt brings these kids forward and said, "Sir Edward, these assembled children of the city of Bristol wish to bring accusation against name of guy," and says they cannot have any cherry ice cream
because
all the cherries in Bristol are concealed in his slops.
His ginormous
in
pants.
In his pants.
In his pants. And I'm going, okay, that's cool. And all these kids, he sets up all these kids, they sort of start wailing. Oh, God, it's so horrible. No ice cream. You know, it's brilliant stuff. You know, the parents are taking pictures and all this. I turn to this guy after a suitable interval and go, "Sir, you standing over there, is it true that you are carrying all the cherries of Bristol in your slops, and therefore these children may not have cherried ice cream?" There are so many things this guy could have said. There's a list. I'm sure Craig is sitting there coming up with a dozen.
Yeah.
That would have been perfect
answers. And they're all built around two words.
Yes, and. And this guy looked at these kids, all the parents, me, all the guards, and went, "No." And we.
That's the sound of the air going out of the bit.
Yeah.
But it was so awful because this bit was working, it was focused, and critically, it was almost over. And now I'm sitting there. And I gave him another shot. I said, "Master, you standing over there who is really in trouble with me right now, are you certain? For indeed, your slops do look like it. Perhaps you deceive the court. Wink, wink, dumbass."
Oh, my God.
And he looks up and says, without any character, without any, he just seems like pissed. Like, "I think it's true, dummy. I don't think you have cherries in your pants. I'm not going to pull your pass because you're stealing cherries. What is wrong with you?" And I look up at him and he says again, without a hint of anything other than, he goes, "No." And I looked up and I said, "Well, there's that then, Kit. take these children to find some ice cream." And I went to his director.
You just have to cut and run at that point.
And I said, I went to his director and I said, I'd never done this. I never gave notes to other directors. Just wasn't my role, wasn't who I was. I said, "Seriously? This guy's got to go. If he's come this far into the season and he doesn't get that, oh my God." So that actually left that's a yet visible scar.
But it's a great story.
No.
And to this day, Jim hasn't eaten cherry ice cream.
I can't look at it.
No.
Dave has joined us today.
Hi, Dave.
For the end of Jim's episode.
Hi, Jim.
Hey there.
And we're going to play a little quiz show modeled after the British show QI. Listeners, if you've never watched QI, you should go do that. And after you listen to our, you should go listen to that after you listen to this, because that'll be much more entertaining. Hopefully we'll actually be able to be kind of interesting here.
QI for our purposes stands for qualitatively intangible.
Well, I'm going to call the show NBQI.
Oh, okay.
Wah, wah. So are we ready to roll?
Let's do it.
Let's play. And we're going to appropriate their music for just a brief little while, and then we're going to cut it down. Hello, welcome to NBQI, our lame adaptation of the popular British quiz show, where the answers are much more interesting than the questions. And the questions are, I hope, because I wrote these, difficult. regardless of whether the panelists get the questions right, I'll award points for being interesting along the way, regardless of whether the answers are correct or even relevant. Let's meet the panel. First up is our bastion of historicity, Jim. Hello, Jim.
Good. Hello, NBQI universe.
Oh, here we go. Our board game designer friend, Dave.
Hey. Oh, there's no applauding for me, apparently. Oh, excellent. Thank you.
And also my co-host, Mike, who will probably go through and edit this in such a way that he wins at the end. All right. Each of the panelists has a buzzer, and everybody kind of has something different because I gave people the opportunity to use their own. Dave goes. Mike goes. Cartman. And Jim goes.
I think we have a winner already.
Hold that up to the mic when you buzz.
Is that better?
Whoa!
That's a little better.
All right. You will know when I am ready.
Yes, and as a heads up, the winner of this little quiz show is going to get a prize. You're going to get to provide the outro for the episode. I don't have to write one. So start thinking about what you might want to say now as we play. So here we go, everybody. Fingers on buzzers. First category is American history. Where did Billy, Tom, and Frank die? Give it a shot. Okay, Jim?
Billy, Tom, and Frank died somewhere near Tulsa, Oklahoma, in a grim shootout with the rest of the James gang.
No, but you're on the right track. Anybody? It's in that same time period, generally speaking.
Can you provide last names?
I could.
Did they die in Tombstone?
They died in Tombstone. Very good, Mike.
Ah.
They died at the OK Corral.
Ah.
There you go. He's going to just give applause to himself. Yeah, Wednesday, October 26th, 1881 in Tombstone, Arizona. The fight lasted about 30 seconds, as opposed to the way it's usually been portrayed in movies, where it's like this two-minute ordeal.
I have no idea who these people are.
Well,
which one of them is the Huckleberry?
It was fought. We're getting there. It was fought between Cowboys Billy Claiborne, Ike and Billy Clanton, and Tom and Frank McClory.
Oh, okay, cool.
On the other side were Virgil Morgan and Wyatt Earp, along with Doc Holliday. At the time in Tombstone, Virgil Earp was the town marshal, and Morgan was his assistant marshal. Wyatt had gotten out of law enforcement for a while. He didn't want any part of it, but he got roped back into it when the Cowboys started causing problems. And then he and Doc were both deputized shortly before all of that happened.
Now, which one did Kirk shoot?
Which one did Kirk shoot?
Yeah.
Was there an episode?
Yeah, the OK Corral. You never saw that one?
Okay. Yeah, vaguely I recall. I don't know. Who do we think he shot? Well, one of the ones that died. So Frank McClory.
There we go.
Or did he screw up the timeline? Go ahead, Jim.
I'd love to know when in film history or when in cultural history we decided that bullets were survivable.
Well, people get grazed. You know, it happens.
I understand, but I've stood in the OK Corral, so I suppose I should have known the answer to the question. It's not much bigger than your average Wendy's parking lot.
No, it's not. It's not. I know that as well. It's I've been there. I saw a reenactment of it.
Well, I've actually been doing a lot of reading about gunshots and things. So okay. There's some interesting things you need to consider here. One of them is that back then, guns kind of sucked compared to what they do today. So that helped. Fair. Although the medicine wasn't there that we have. And that's the counterpoint for today. The hospitals report that a surprising number of gunshot wounds are survivable if you get medical attention within a reasonable amount of time.
The golden hour.
Yeah, and it's like a reasonable amount of time, not even rapidly kind of a thing. It's okay. Like it's really hard to kill a person with a single gunshot. Like even in spots where you're like, oh, they're gone. You know, it's like study shows like, no, you know, like 85% survival rate.
If they can get help.
Yeah, if they can get help.
Modern day.
Yeah, modern day.
Right.
But guns back then sucked is my counterpoint.
This is why Virgil brought the room sweeper. Okay, gotcha.
Well, in the movie, anyway. Ike and Billy Claiborne ran from the fight unharmed. Billy Clanton and both of the McClories were killed. Of the lawmen, only Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday escaped unscathed. Morgan and Virgil were both wounded and did not die. Hmm. Although they did die later. Not too much later.
I was 6 seconds from it. You beat me to it. They were immortal. I knew it.
Were they both grazed in the arm and prevented them from walking?
In the left arm.
Prevented them from walking?
Sure.
Because that happens.
Oh, right. In movies, you get shot in the arm and you have to be helped out.
Well, was it intelligence? Was that where you saw
that?
Yeah.
Well, imagine that my laser tag strategy works well in an actual gunfight, and that you put your gun over your your arm over your vital areas so it cannot be shot. So, you know, you get shot in the arm with a real gun, you know, you can use the other hand. Block the sensor with laser tag.
Speaking of using the other hand, 2 months after the gunfight, Virgil was wounded in his left arm, leaving it permanently crippled.
Interesting.
But he continued to be a lawman. He was righty. Morgan was assassinated like a year and a half later. He was shot while he was playing pool.
That's a rough game.
Died on the pool table. Yeah. Well, he was shot from outside the building. Oh, okay. Somebody was lurking in the darkness. Wyatt Earp was never hit by a bullet once in his entire life, despite all the confrontations he got into. Doc Holliday, of course, got tuberculosis, thought he was going to die, moved out west because of the dry air, figured he'd just live out his life and you know, kind of hope that he would go out in a hail of gunfire. Did anybody know what his final words were?
Today's a good day to die. He just sounds like a Klingon at this point.
No, we're going to say no on that. Okay. This is funny. A nurse reports him saying that. That's the last reported words that he spoke.
That is awesome and badass.
Lying in his bed, thinking, supposedly, I was expecting to get murdered at a poker table or get shot in the street, and here I am dying of tuberculosis.
In a hospital.
In a hotel. Yeah.
But with a nurse.
Yeah, with somebody attending.
Have I mentioned how disappointed I am that we found out how Oliver Reed actually died?
Oh, okay.
This makes me sad. I'd always known that during the filming of Gladiator, he died on the island of Malta where they were shooting, because apparently he was in the company of a bunch of men from the Royal Navy. And it turns out, and it was always listed, I have a shirt, actually, Famous English Drunks and How They Died. And his is listed as missing in action. But now that's not true. It turns out that as he was getting up from his table to leave to return to his hotel room, 14 men from the HMS Southern showed up. And he stayed there and consumed, I kid you not, 20 more rounds. And died of alcohol poisoning. Gentlemen.
There we go. I was hoping that's where that was going. The lesson wasn't going to be. And, you know, then he had a heart attack. Well, I suppose that could happen, too. But, you know, he had an aneurysm.
Then his liver leapt from his body and ran out of the room.
Shall we jump to American Disasters? As opposed, not this yes, podcast.
Let's jump into them.
Yes. What happened at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in 1911?
Oh, there was a fire and they failed to have... Oh, wait. There was a fire and they failed to have proper safety codes. And so the women were trapped on the upper floors and forced to jump to their death.
Jeez, Dave. Yeah, pretty much exactly what happened. March 29th, 1911. Yeah. It resulted in the fourth highest loss of life from an industrial accident in U.S. history. 123 women and 23 men died from fire, smoke inhalation, or falling to their deaths.
Okay, I just want to say something real quick here.
How did you know this?
American history, ninth grade, man.
Okay.
Jeez. Anyways.
It's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Also, there's a surprising amount of short stories written about it and ghosts and unhappy spirits. It's a common recurring theme.
So. Okay, well, to throw this out there for everybody, why didn't more people get out?
It's funny. We have a building in downtown Milwaukee called the Germania Building.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually the home of the first – it was actually the largest German-language socialist newspaper in the world at the turn of the century, 19th century to the 20th. And they're thinking about turning it into – a residence and turning it into moderate income housing right in the heart of downtown Milwaukee, which would be kind of a nice thing to have. One of the major problems they're having, the windows don't open.
Oh, that's a problem.
And we actually have a zoning code that says the windows must open in all residences of any kind, and they must have a window. I.e., if you have a residential property, it has to have a window that faces out. And
out of
open.
The building, not into a courtyard or a central, you know.
That would be awful.
Well, no, to the office of the guy next to you.
Right.
You know, but the thing that struck me when they brought this to my attention, that they're working on this from a historical preservation standpoint because it's going to be expensive, was, wait a minute. We have a law on our books that says that. That implies there was once a time when that wasn't the case.
Oh, yeah.
And it just makes you want to go through the zoning code and go, what else did we assume was not required?
So your answer is they had inoperable windows.
Well, no, my answer specifically is they had inadequate building codes to provide sufficient protection to the people inside.
Okay.
Impertinences for getting out of a building.
In a roundabout way, that's true. The big issue was that... Wait, go ahead, Mike.
They lacked panic hardware on the doors.
That's very true.
Of course it was. It was when?
but specifically, the owners locked the doors to the stairwells and exits, which was a common practice to prevent pilferage and unauthorized smoking breaks. So they trapped them all inside. And ultimately, this did lead to a great deal of legislation.
Yes.
Which led to the growth of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which fought for better working conditions for sweatshop workers. There were women in that building as young as 13 who died. It was a full-on sweatshop.
Now, I have a question for you, Craig.
Okay. Do I get points?
You do get points.
It was a shirtwaist shop.
Yes. It was a garment factory, and that's why it caught fire very quickly once it started going, because there was scraps of material everywhere.
And what is a shirt waist?
I don't know. Why don't you tell us and earn points?
Dave, you're the shirt waist expert.
I actually am not the shirt waist expert. I just wanted to say it in a tone that implied like I was.
Okay.
But I'm really dying to know this, Craig. When you first approached us about this show, you're mm-hmm. like, you know, the answers, you know, you're going to have comebacks, so it's going to be lighthearted, we're going to have some fun with it. And then the first two questions you give us are about a bloody shootout and women dying in a...
Well, men died too.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, we don't care.
As long as it's equal.
There were 23 of them. No, it's not even close to equal. It's a lot more women. It's just one of those things. That's where I went. I knew I was going to go either Civil War or Old West for something, because that's my wheelhouse.
Oh, that's true.
His next topic is the Battle of Verdun.
Actually, the next topic is the Animal Kingdom.
Oh, okay. There's nothing bad or evil there.
No, this actually, now that I think about it, this has something to do with kind of with killing. The duck-billed platypus is one of very few poisonous mammals.
I knew that.
On the earth. What's notable about its venom?
Oh, I think I know this.
Yes, Dave?
It's it's in the quills, right?
And you're pointing at?
My quills. I'm pointing at my shoulders, man. But no, yeah, it's the venom's in the quills, not like in their fangs or anything.
Okay, you're close. It's not in their mouth. No teeth. Duck-billed.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody go a little further with that? We'll give Dave a point. Oh, Mike. Yes?
Oh, that was a simultaneous buzz.
Oh, okay.
Do you have a tiebreaker rule?
No.
Game design, you need a tiebreaker rule.
Jim, go. When in doubt, screw Mike over.
That is the ultimate tie-breaking rule.
Jim?
It can be synthesized from the tears of children.
No, that's not. Mike, you want to offer up yours?
Is it in its penis?
No.
It's not a cat.
I'm going to give you negative 1 point for that. No, it's in spurs on its legs.
Oh. So it's like a cowboy.
Kind of. Females have the spurs as well, but there's they lose them during their adolescent development, but males keep them. The poison is not deadly to humans, but it is excruciatingly painful.
Mm. Like
and that's
jokes.
Just yet one other way that the platypus is a hodgepodge of things. It's like, you know, you got the big bin of parts at the end. What do we got left over? We got enough for one more animal? It's got poisonous spurs on their legs, but only for the men. Let's see. Next, the English language. What's the origin of the word swagger? Bored. Hmm. Anybody? Take a shot?
Can we change the question to the origin of the word okay?
Okay. No.
I can go on about that one.
Somebody invented it, I'll say that. Who invented it?
Jim? Buzzing in.
Jim's buzzing in and his phone won't be quiet now, so you're going to get the long what does the fox say.
Sure.
I'm only going to associate with this fact that most of the bosuns and bosun's mates on English shipping had a swagger stick.
All right.
So I'm going to surmise that it was some method of encouraging an individual to be about their task.
No.
Bugger.
We're going to say but it was invented by somebody. The word doesn't derive from mm-hmm. It didn't have the normal etymological growth from other words in previous languages. Mm. It was invented by Shakespeare.
Okay.
Okay, everybody's like, well, really? Okay.
Surprise, Shakespeare invented a word?
He invented over 1,700 of them.
That's the sarcasm. Apparently had a thing for adjectives, I think, right?
Well, he did it by changing verbs into adjectives, nouns into verbs, connecting words that had never been used before together, and adding prefixes and suffixes. I mean, he used previous words, but he kind of, turned them into something else.
And yet my English teacher got mad at me when I did the same. And it's like, like, listen, lady, you love Shakespeare, and he did it all the time. Oh, what inspired Swagger? I'm kind of curious now.
It's from a Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 3, Scene 1. Puck says, "What hempen homespuns have we swaggering here, so near the cradle of the fairy queen?" And it's pretty much what we think of the word to mean today. It's referring to carrying oneself in an insolent or supercilious manner, displaying dominance. Okay.
Now, I'm going to the OED to find out where he got that from. Is it just a neologism as far as we know?
I would guess. You'd have to. I don't have that. I didn't get that deep into the history of it. But there you go. Homework for your next appearance on the show.
Dirty linguistic tease.
There you go. Okay. Let's jump to general ignorance. That's our last little round. It's sort of a lightning round. 10 points for a right answer, but negative 10 for anything terribly, horribly wrong.
I feel like we need a couple more questions then to bump up our scores just so we have a fighting chance.
No.
I'm going to be like Sean Connery on Jeopardy over here.
Okay. Just going to start calling me names.
Curse you and your daily doubles, Trebek.
So fingers on buzzers, because this is a, I got to ring in and get the answer. In horse and rider statuary, what did the number of hooves lifted into the air signify?
These are lightning round questions?
You're supposed to know this one. Nobody's ever heard this. Take a guess. Mike.
Wins.
What?
Number of wins.
No, that's wrong.
The number of hooves in their horses aren't that smart, are they?
No, the story is, and it's completely false.
He's Jim's sorry. Buzzing in.
Jim?
Losses.
No, negative points for you. And actually, more negative points than Mike got because you built upon a bad answer.
Well, then that stops me from saying what I was about to say.
Okay. It's like, I'm just going to stick with what I've got. No, I thought for sure one of you guys would know this and be able to buzz in that the belief is that it has to do with what happened to the rider. one hoof in the air, the rider was injured in battle. One, two hooves in the air, the rider died in battle.
Huh.
Both feet, all feet on the ground, the rider survived. And that's not the case. If you study any number of statues, you'll see it's all over the place. It's a myth. That apparently none of you knew about.
I have a hard enough time keeping straight with a flame on the Wisconsin natural gas building means.
Right.
That's a thing up here.
Yeah, it's the weather predictor. It's a forecast machine, a big bright light on top of a building. All right. What were George Washington's dentures made from? Mike?
Wood?
No. Jim?
Ivory.
Close, yeah, partly. Gold, hippopotamus ivory, lead.
Always a good move.
And human and animal teeth, including horse and donkey teeth.
That's ballin', man. That's all I have to say.
That is a man who is staring death in the mouth.
That's some sweet grill.
But here's the thing about it. They had those teeth on display at Mount Vernon forever. And so how the notion of the wooden thing came about has always been something of an enigma to me.
The most common theory is that Washington's dentures, all of the different pieces, became stained over time, giving them a grained wooden appearance. It was just the coloring.
So some guy wandered through the Mount Vernon History Museum and said, hey, I think those are made out of wood, and it stuck.
I guess somebody.
The bigger question I have is, how hard off was our country that the president couldn't get a replacement pair of dentures?
Well, Washington didn't really want to, and he kind of did it because he was cajoled into it. He didn't really want to be president.
All right, you got me there.
He was a general. He was a military guy. He didn't want to run. You know,
now that is
political.
Actually that's intimidating. Having hippopotamus teeth and like you know,
and hippopotami are responsible for more deaths per year than what is it? Sharks, bears, and lions all combined, or something like that.
Hmm.
They're incredibly deadly animals because they're enormous.
We assume they're slow.
No, well, all it takes is one misstep on your part. No matter how slow your adversary is, goof up once and you're done.
Right. They're like gravity, our eternal foe, always waiting.
All right, one more.
Well, the thing I find interesting is that there's actually a statistic for number of people that die by vending machines falling on them. It doesn't
sure.
matter what the number is.
I read a statistic about death by tea cozies as well.
Really? That wins.
What you got? Every year at my office, we have to file a report with OSHA. Bear in mind, I'm the city clerk for the city of Milwaukee. We're the clerk's office. Okay.
Right.
We have a 6-page report in which we have to do things like mangled by machine.
Go back to the New Year's episode of this podcast. There's the whole story. All right, one
that
more.
That was more than mangled.
Yeah,
though.
One more. It
was
pressed.
Was pureed.
What is one more? What is the name of the first video game?
Oh, that's a trick question.
That's yes, it is. It's General Ignorance, Mike. Or sorry, that's Dave.
That's Dave. Fox and Hound. I read about that in the History of Video Games book.
It was
actually...
Do you have a year on that? I didn't have that one in my little list here.
It actually had no intelligence behind it. It was just two light pointers on the back of a cathode ray tube. And so there was no detection of collision or anything, so it was all player judged.
Oh, okay.
So I'm thinking it must have been based on the old timiness of the photos, like in the 50s or something like that.
Okay, well, this might fall right in with... something that I got on there. Do you want anybody else? That's as far, if we're going to go with the 50s, I'm going to say that's not the oldest. Mm. Mike?
Ping.
Pong?
Wow, you got the wrong answer wrong.
Ping.
I'm going to give you extra negative points for that.
Came before Pong.
Right, right. Wah, wah. No, Pong, yeah, a lot of people think it's Pong. That's 1972. There was a game much like Pong called Space War. That happened came out in 1961. It's a predecessor. It's the first vector display shooter game. Mm. There were a number of games that bridged Space War to Pong, but the one that I came across and that I from what I can tell is there's a game called Cathode Ray Tube Amusement Device. Literally what it was named by Thomas T. Goldsmith Jr. and Essel Ray Mann. It was a missile simulator inspired by radar displays from World War II, and it used analog circuitry to display or to control the CRT beam and position a dot on the screen. Screen overlays were used for targets because they couldn't do graphics. And
yes.
That was in 1947.
Okay.
Wow.
So, yeah, very similar technology to what I was talking about.
What does the DLC look like for that?
Apparently a different screen overlay from what Craig is saying.
Yeah,
get some saran wrap and a marker.
Comes in the mail.
Okay, we're going to take a short break while I tally scores, and then we'll do the outro. Think about what you want to talk about if you win. All right, final score time, everybody. Mike, as expected, because he took the bullet a couple of times, comes in with a negative 14.
Yes.
Hey. Woo!
Jim, with a 5, is in second place, solidly in the positive numbers.
Good job, Jim.
Yay, Jim. And Dave, because he came right out of the gate with the shirt waist factory and did a good job of avoiding getting suckered a number of times, wins the game with 19.
Wow.
I'd like to dedicate this win to my ninth grade history teacher, Mr. Rogers. I'm not looking forward to doing the outro, so I'm actually kind of doing a spiteful dedication.
All right. But you've got an outro ready?
We'll see what happens.
I'll point at you when you need to start talking.
Okay.
How's that sound? All right. Well, Jim, thank you for being on the show again.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, absolutely glad to be here. Always a pleasure, guys. Thank you.
And Dave, thanks for swinging by here to give us more than two panelists for our little quiz show.
And we'll see you next week.
Yeah. Mike, where can they find us?
NerdBurgerShow.com, at NerdBurgerShow on the Twitters and Facebook, and email us, NerdBurgerShow@gmail.com.
On the next episode of Nerdburger, Craig passes the buck on doing the outro to his next guest, who's completely unprepared and unready.
Wow.
On the next episode after that, that guest passed it back to Mike. On the next episode after that, I've got nothing.
Am I that lazy?
No, that's me.
Oh, true.
No, you did a great job with all those questions. You needed a break.
Bye.
Bye-bye.